ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Film Philosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Film Philosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Van Weven, and alongside me, as always, is my co-host, Chad Secret Spy Riley.
Or is he?
That was kind of piratey. I don't know why
I did that.
I
felt like you could have thrown in the is he. the things we do to amuse ourselves.
I'm disguising me voice.
We have an exciting show that is not about pirates.
You don't sound very excited.
I am stoked.
I am stoked.
You're always stoked. It's true.
I am always
you
stoked.
You are like in non-stop.
I'm also always woke and swole. That's dope, bro.
I forgot to turn off.
I warned you before this started that I'm in a weird mood today.
I forgot to turn off the millennial button on chat. But we got a great show in store for you today. The Film Philosophers is presented with altered voice modulation by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week in a safe house operated by VGB Studios. Every episode of The Film Philosophers is a cipher for something else, and we invite you to follow the clues each Wednesday on Audioboom, Player FM, Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, or Libsyn. Carrying multiple passports from different countries under a variety of cover identities? Use each of them separately to like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101 for updates from Hollywood and beyond. Last but not least, you can do recon on all of our previous episodes at VGBstudios.com alongside secret messages from other amazing podcasts like Video Game Bang and me, Mike Self, and I gotta say, Chad, I think Chad has his little bit of time to just totally gush in terms of writing, and he has fun with these notes, because I finish them at the beginning of the day, or some part of the day, I'll finish them and I'll send them over to Chad, and everything that happens after the fact is all in his hands, so this entire beginning part of the show is solely in his hands, and he usually has a little bit of fun with that.
A little bit. Today I had a lot.
Well, I mean...
because I love what we're talking about today.
It's true. If you haven't gotten the idea quite yet, we are talking about spy movies. And not just spy movies, but the actual genre of espionage itself. I don't know if many of you know this, but like Chad said, Chad is a huge fan of spy movies. If you've ever
love
seen
them.
His collection, he's got a ton of spy films like all over the place.
Yeah, like half of them.
And he's got a good chunk.
But not just the famous ones. Like some of them are... I mean, like, we were talking some that we're not going to mention because, you know, they're not really a major part of the genre, so not like this.
It's true. I'm listening to and I'm like, I'm getting into the
mood. I know,
mood.
You're zoning back into the... I mean, why are we even talking over this music?
Is this why another bodyguard that? Moment that we have?
It might be. We might have to restart the show and just let the music play.
As we gear up for Kingsman, The Golden Circle, debuting next Friday, the smash sequel to 2014's spy hit, we decided to take a look back at the iconic genre and do what we do best.
Talk for a long time.
We dig a little deeper. We're going to take a closer look at the history of the espionage genre in film.
I love how you soft-pitched that to me and I totally whiffed.
I was like... the ball is up, it goes, and strike! It's okay.
At least they didn't say something weird, like stand on our heads, write in invisible ink.
I honestly probably would have liked
steal
that.
A luxury yacht and
see,
cruise out into the
every
bay.
Every single one of those would have been so much better than what you said.
Put on a backpack that's actually a helicopter and fly out of the scene.
Most definitely. So we're going to take a
pick
closer...
up rocket launchers and shoot at each other.
We're not Boba Fett.
Put on a disguise. Sorry, I'm just you can continue.
No, you
have lovely notes prepared for this show, and I want to give you time to say them.
Because Chad plans on taking over in a little bit. So yeah, you know what? We're going to take a closer look at the history of this genre and see where the franchise has birthed, where it's risen, where it's even fallen at certain times, and where it is today. So like I said, this genre is one of the oldest genres in the history of cinema, in the history of just any form of art altogether. If you look at literature, this thing goes back pretty far.
You're stuck on the music.
I am stuck on the music.
I mean, honestly, there's so much richness in the genre of spy stories, because, you know, there's a little bit of that escapism component, then there's the secrecy, there's a little bit of, like, usually some sort of a soap opera moment or two in these stories. Back in the day, I mean, I'm thinking, like, old medieval monarchy courts, like the intrigue of the court, and if people mm-hmm. are trying to, you know, speak against each other behind closed doors and scheme and connive and poison each other's drinks and things, all the way back into the ancient world. I mean, ancient kings and pharaohs had cupbearers. Their job was to taste test and make sure that the stuff wasn't poisoned before the guy at the head of the table got to eat it or drink it or whatever, or the woman. You know, but it's a well respected, I guess you could say. I mean, some of it's kind of dastardly, but it's a well respected stream of storytelling that has a long history.
And of course, with every great and impactful genre in film, like we were just saying, there is always a rich history in literature. And so as we're going to talk a little bit, we're going to kind of hit a little bit on the history of this genre, not just, of course, in film, but also in literature, and just kind of touch on some of the basic foundations that created what we now know as the modern spy flick. So, going back to the 19th century in literature, in the 1800s, the world first saw its first glimpses at espionage novels with 1821's The Spy and 1831's The Bravo. The Bravo was actually a unique novel that was about, it actually fought against European anti-republicanism by depicting Venice as a city-state where a ruthless oligarchy wears the mask of the, quote, serene republic. The interest in spy novels, however, kind of arose during the latter part of the 19th century due to a French incident known as the Dreyfus Affair, which actually the entire event lasted for about 5 years. The details were reported by the world press, an Imperial German penetration agent betraying to Germany the secrets of the general staff of the French army, the French counterintelligence riposte of sending a charwoman to rifle the trash in the German embassy in Paris, were news that inspired successful spy fictions. It was a really big.
So say that in radio terms. It's good to read off of the notes, but for those of you listening, I don't know that you caught all of it. So basically, the German Empire at the time,
yes,
sent an agent to go and, like, you know, rifle through papers and steal secrets from the French army.
Yes,
and then, like, succeeded, and so then the French sent someone else to Germany to, like, dig through the trash.
And not just anybody, they sent a
woman. Oh, no, they didn't send her to Germany, excuse me. They sent her to the embassy in Paris, and she, like, just dug through the trash to find sensitive information.
And this lasted over the course of 5 years, so this was constant. Nobody really found out about what had actually happened until after the fact. And then the world kind of went into a headspin when there was talk of, you know, the Great War, you know, the first big world war, because this is when countries started, you know, fighting against each other. This is ultimately where it all started in certain cases. But this transitions us into 20th century literature as well as film. So like we said, it wasn't until the turn of the century that the espionage genre began to dig into more global issues such as war. This was also the time that gave birth to iconic characters such as Sherlock Holmes, one of the first novels that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle wrote was a book in 1904 called The Adventure of the Second Stain, and 1912's The Adventure of the Bruce Partington Plans.
Was Sherlock Holmes a spy?
He was.
He was a detective.
No. He actually, he had him play a double agent in the first book, I believe it was. He played a double agent to the German army. I rifled through a couple of the books and just getting a gist of it, but he actually played a double agent for King of the Country.
Hey, I have to say, Sherlock Holmes is much more interesting to me now.
Hey, there you go.
I didn't know that before. Now watch, we're going to get comments and things about how, well, in the Guy Ritchie original film, he talks about his history as a spy, and I don't pay attention to those details. I just look for the explosions.
It's true.
Okay, so crickets from you. Do you want me to take over reading from your notes?
No, sorry. The littlest things that distract me. From there, that's when film actually began to kind of take over literature at the time in terms of spy
media.
Well,
it was a new way of experiencing stories, mm-hmm. you know, in the early 20th century with the moving pictures. No sound just yet mm-hmm. in the beginning of the 20th century, but you could go to the theater and see a moving picture. And that was a big moment in, you know, culture.
Yeah. We actually touched a little bit, of this in a previous episode, when we were talking about women behind the scenes, in film and talking about kind of where the silent film era kind of brought itself in and began to take over in terms of the dominating form of media. But as the spy film genre began in the silent era, it actually began as a response to the paranoia of invasion literature because of the coming of the Great War. So the big talk of the war that was coming in terms of World War I, and invasion literature ultimately was literature or novels or short stories or novellas that were talking about or that were leaning towards the idea of a country or a place being invaded by a bigger power or by even just another malicious country. And so this literature began making its way to the United States. It started making its way actually all over, and people were beginning to get scared. So because of that, someone was like, hey, we can make a movie about this. And, you know, they just began to start.
It's probably one of those things. I mean, you're sitting there and you're probably in these days that, you know, it's silent film. And so you've got to tell a story just with the moving images, you mm-hmm. know, the essentially pantomime.
Yeah.
And set decoration, whatever else you do. So you're probably sitting there scratching your head thinking, okay, well, how do we communicate a story that's going to speak very strongly without audible dialogue?
Yeah.
You know, like what's going to connect with people who are scared in Europe specifically of a foreign power invading their land? And so part of what they came up with as interesting story ideas, they were, I guess you could say, the progenitors of spy films, the ones that came before all the others.
It's true, because if you look at the early films that we've actually dug into, you have 1914's The German Spy Peril, which entirely was a plot about blowing up the House of Parliament, which if you think about it at the time, nowadays, it's a more commonplace thing. I mean, we've seen movies like, what is that? London Has Fallen. Have you seen...
Oh, it gets blown up and terrorized all the time, yeah.
I mean, the whole V for Vendetta film was focused on...
In movies,
on the,
not in real life.
Yeah, obviously. No way. And please, if you're from, you know, that part of the world and you think we're making threats, we're not. But this type of thing is more commonplace. But then at the time, having people create a film or having thoughts of like, oh, the Germans were planning to blow up Parliament, it began to incite a certain sense of, I guess, bias, if you will, in certain cases. Like, this is where a lot of, I don't want to use the word propaganda because it's not propaganda, but a lot of people begin to implement, like, ideas of, like, oh, we have to be U.S. strong and, you know, these people are doing this, or, you know, you have to be British proud or all these kinds, all this kinds of stuff. Because even the next film that we were talking about, 1913's OHMS, which is, what is it, On His, or Of His Majesty's Service,
mm-hmm.
Is a film actually with the same premise as The German Spy Peril. And uniquely enough, this film is actually one of the first films to introduce for the first time a strong female character who helps the hero. Uniquely enough, this format is something that kind of takes, evolves and is taken by another later character that we'll mention in our, you know, chronological order of things. But there's someone else who ends up taking a strong female character and uses that to help his escapades and adventures and whatnot. So, but these are the types of films that when the film era, like we said, the silent film era began, these were some of the things that kind of started off what people were to, you know, recognize as cinema, as, you know, movies, moving pictures. And so, you know.
Well, I mean, you've got an interesting, a lot of times with the spy film, the spy stories, you have, you know, not only the escapism component, because you're oftentimes dealing with either people that you're meant to relate to in another type of environment where you've never been, or you're dealing with more sinister agents of another area that you've never been to coming into your home area and doing things. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of intrigue around simply the unknown, because spy films have this interesting confluence of there's a lot of action sometimes. There's the thriller aspect. There's sometimes a detective whodunit kind of element to many of them. And then you also have, well, I lost my train of thought. What else do you have?
Well, and then you have the intelligence aspect of it as well. You know, somebody who is extremely smart and just extremely unique to be able to find his way out of a certain situation, and that's why he is who he is.
Sure. Well, and I had a good other thought, but it'll come up later. we can move on. I don't want to belabor the point, but you know, it's an intersection of various other types of stories. Mm-hmm. Oh, conspiracies. That was the other thing. I mean, we know people who are armchair conspiracy theorists, you know, like there's a bit of a, there's that inherent suspicion of the powers that be, and, a belief that in many cases, what you see is a facade or a front to other more secretive activities in various different aspects of life, not specifically just with spies, but the spy genre usually does have a conspiracy element to it. In addition to the whodunit, the action, the intrigue, you know, the sometimes there's, you know, a battle of the sexes. You know, there's a lot going on in many of the films and books and short stories and whatever that are part of this genre.
It's true. And so a lot of that, I mean, even at a time in place where the looming of war was nearby, and it was, they were pretty much on the cusp of beginning the first world war. It was still a point of intrigue for a lot of people because of the fact that it was like an inside look into things that almost people would want to aspire to become, like, you know, being able to have every tool under your metaphorical tool belt, if you will, and being able to get out of any situation while doing it all for king and country, depending on where you're at, you know, if you're from the U.S., obviously for the country and so forth. You know what I mean? But that allure was there, obviously, and it created so much of a draw for people who were going to movies at the time that it never kind of was pushed back. It was never really like subdued. It was just, it continued on, thankfully.
Well, it essentially it gains steam.
Oh,
I
yeah.
Mean, in a
yeah.
way.
And that's what I mean, you know, in terms of it never was like at a point where like, oh, you know, we're in times of war. You can't be doing movies like that. Or we're in, you know, we're on the cusp of something really, really bad that's about to happen. You can't be, you have to be more patriotic and all that. This, in a sense, is one of the forms of cinema that's like closest to patriotism, if you will, because normally the spy is who he is and does what he does for the sake of where he comes from.
Yeah, to protect the sanctity of their home country. Yeah, and you've got the whole, obviously there's oftentimes a fish out of water element. I mean, there's a lot working in favor of these types of stories because, you know, it is, I care so much about keeping my family, country, brethren, you know, whatever you want to say, you know, keeping them safe. Well, I mean, in some cases, you do have some spy type tropes that are more sinister, and that they're yeah. they're really just, you know, for the thrill of it, or because they want to cause damage to somebody else. But oftentimes, you're right, there is a patriotic element to it, and that's kind of the thing that excuses a lot of the behavior of the main characters and even some of the secondary characters in these stories, because they do things that are not, let's say, popularly acceptable. You know, if they're, you know, quite frankly, if they're spying on people, then yeah. that there's a negative connotation to that, you know, and then you've got things like poison or assassination yeah. or coordinating other forces to do those things. And, you know, those are not generally, you know, accepted in polite society. Those are not like something you would tell somebody, you know, on the bus, like, yeah. oh yeah, I totally gathered intel on,
yeah, yeah.
On your sister. And, I sent information to a foreign government to have her, executed. Like that's not something that you would ever
the way you put it. Oh my gosh.
But, you know, a lot of times that's what these characters are involved in at some level.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the fact that there is that patriotic component, that, that drive to do something for a good reason, even if yeah. the something that you're doing is not a good something that you're doing, that, you know, ultimately helps the character stay redeemable in the eyes of the audience.
Yeah. And that's, and I know we're kind of digressing, but to kind of elaborate a little bit more too, I mean, because that's ultimately what a spy is someone who is willing to do the dirty work for his country, for the sake of the fact that he feels a need to, as opposed to anybody who does it for more malicious reasons or whatnot. There are other terms for it. It's more of like traitor, or it's more of like, you know, deviant. There's a more negative connotation on that aspect. If you're somebody who is, you know, I'm here to do the job for the queen, or I'm here to do this work for the president, or I'm here to do it for the emperor, whoever it may be, it's usually within the positive connotation of, you know what, I do what no one else should have to do for the sake
yeah,
of...
Yeah, I do it so you don't have to.
Exactly. So, back on point, because like we said...
Oh, don't worry. I was setting you up for your next thing. You don't know it, but I was.
Oh, no. I totally...
Let's talk about Fritz.
So, Fritz Lang, one of the most infamous directors in the first half of the 20th century. Fritz Lang created a film called Spies, which back in 1928 was a really unique film, because this was around the time when spy films now became more of a commonplace thing. And so people were shooting spy films quite often, but this was the film that actually began to establish a lot of the many tropes that became popular in later spy dramas, including the idea of having a secret headquarters, an agent known by a number, and the beautiful foreign agent who comes to love the hero. Lang's Dr. Mabuse films from the period also contained elements of spy thrillers, through the central character is a though the central character is a criminal mastermind only interested in espionage for profit. And that goes back to what we were talking about in terms of kind of the labels. Somebody who does it for malicious reasons has another title, as opposed to the one who is the protagonist, if you will, the hero of the story. He is doing it for king and country, or for whatever reasons like that.
Right, I mean, you've got your ingenious versus nefarious.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly.
And those are opposing forces, and it depends on which side, sometimes, it depends on which side of the story your point of view is set, you know, that determines how you feel about people on one side versus the other. Obviously, you also have, eventually, the more cartoonish villains, as in several of the James Bond films, which we'll talk about in a moment, and other subsequent films as well, where that's less it is really a lot more one-sided because of the way the antagonist is characterized and portrayed.
Yeah. Additionally, several of Lang's American films, so I don't know if many of you know this, but Fritz Lang is actually an Austrian director. He did a lot of his films in Austria, in his hometown of, what was it? It was Vienna. He did a lot of his films.
Oh, that little old place.
That little old place. But he eventually began doing American films because it became more of a prosperous thing to actually create films where a studio was going to pay top dollar for him. Just simple career change.
Well, and I, frankly, when he was making movies, America in general was a much more stable economy and market altogether at that time. I mean, he started this spies movie was in between the wars. It was after World War One, before World War Two, which means the active part of his career would have taken place in like essentially war-torn Europe.
Yeah.
Like in between both world wars, like the two largest battle catastrophe scenarios of the modern age at the very least. And so obviously it makes sense that he would move his operations to America once the opportunity presented itself, because the economy wasn't in shambles. In fact, had rebounded very strongly following World War II.
Yeah. Several of Lang's American films, such as Hangmen Also Die, deal with spies during World War II. So to kind of just cap in terms of his career, in terms of spies or spy films, that's kind of where that cap ended off. Another director who did a lot to popularize the spy film genre in the 1930s was Alfred Hitchcock. The man known for creating...
The master of suspense.
Exactly, the master of suspense, the man behind a lot of the infamous movies such as Psycho and The House on... He's done so many unique films, had a hand in popularizing the spy film genre. With films like The Man Who Knew Too Much back in 1934, The 39 Steps in 1935, Sabotage in 1937, The Lady Vanishes in 1938. These are all consecutive films, one right after another, except for 1936. He was probably... He took
like a dog with a bone. He just got fixated on it.
These often involved innocent civilians being caught up in international conspiracies or webs of saboteurs on the home front. But some were also based on author W. Somerset Maugham's Ashenden stories or the Mr. Moto series based on the books of John P. Marquand. So it's funny because you think of Alfred Hitchcock and the first thing you think are usually some of his more suspense thriller aspects of his films.
Sure.
Even the Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Hour that he used to have on TV, which thankfully was on Netflix and I got to be able to catch as many of them as possible. That seemed to be one of the few things that I knew him for. I never knew he had a hand in the spy film genre aspect until I was doing these notes. And I'm like, man, this guy really wore multiple hats in terms of his creative outlet and what he was doing with cinema.
Well, and they have a lot in common. I mean, a lot of the, at least what spy stories have evolved to be, a lot of the more maybe dated concept of spies, you know, you didn't have a ticking time bomb that was limiting your window of opportunity for making a crucial decision, and you didn't have you know, weapons of mass destruction in play and all these things that we now have in our more modernized versions of spy stories that kind of, you know, they move the story along. The older concept of spies is really a long con. I mean, it's not it's not a short, truncated hour and a half to 2 hour storytelling experience or lifestyle. It's you embed yourself in another culture as if you're one of them or somebody from another culture that's reputable and not a spy in order to, you know, politicize, gain favor, rise in stature, and then sabotage things. You know, it's a much longer play, and a lot of that is the intrigue and the mystery and what now you've had popularized as the puzzle box, right?
Yeah.
Through with, you know, J.J. Abrams and a bunch of his other creators that kind of follow that mentality of making sure that the story that you're telling, you know, if you are telling a long form story, you've got to have layers and intricacies that unfold over time to keep people interested at each step. And I think that part has a lot, number one, it has a lot in common with mysteries or detective stories. Like I'm thinking, you know, Agatha Christie, Murder on the Orient Express, which we have yet another adaptation coming, you know, in the coming months, which looks phenomenal. But, you know, you've got a lot of intrigue around, you know, those mystery thriller kind of things. But also in terms of how the genre has evolved, I think it owes a lot to Hitchcock because he was the master of really holding an audience in the palm of his hand and, you know, keeping them thinking, keeping them on edge, keeping them wondering, taking some of their, I guess you could say, like media darling performers and showing a totally different side of them in his stories, that, you know, just it opened people's eyes and their perceptions in terms of some of the more the shadier side of humanity in a safe space, the safe space of, you know, the entertainment, you know, the movie theater or the television screen, you know, that you can kind of have these experiences, not literally, but vicariously through the characters.
And I think that's one of the driving factors in terms of the allure of the spy genre is the fact of living vicariously through a character that is doing some of the things that you wish you could. Kind of like this next character that we're kind of talk about. Around the 1950s, an author by the name of Ian Fleming began writing spy novels, starting with his first title called Casino Royale. 12 novels and 2 short story collections later, the man had created an icon. His last 2 books, The Man with the Golden Gun and Octopussy and the Living Daylights, were published posthumously. So if you haven't gathered yet, this is the author who created James Bond, Agent 007 himself.
Indeed.
Yes. although his character's film
and who
career,
was the author was allegedly had some spy experience himself.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah.
And obviously changed quite a lot of the context and the story development. You know, it wasn't so much based on his life experiences, but in a way he did kind of occasionally promote it as though he had a lot of these types of experiences, you know, with the womanizing and the alcohol and the flashy, you know, whatever, all that kind of stuff that we've come to be very familiar with after, what, 25 movies, 24?
I think it's about 25 movies right now.
Yeah.
Although his character's film career started with an hour-long climax mystery theater episode of Casino Royale, many regard Dr. No to be his first film. With over 8 different actors portraying the sleuthy spy, the character holds the record for longest, quote, living character in cinema. So if you're familiar with any amount of, like, just culture or just whatnot in terms of movies, you'll know James Bond just from, you know, the couple of things that he said, the major quotes such as, you know, Bond, James Bond, or, you know, shaken, not stirred. You know, you know some of these ones as well as some other ones that, you know, he said, you know, oh, I mean to kill you, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's really interesting. Yeah. Blofeld.
Well, obviously, you're if you're above the age of, let's say, 8.
Yeah.
Even if you've never seen one of these films, you know who James Bond is.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you have been exposed to the character somehow, whether from the older films or the newer ones.
Yeah. So James Bond practically just sculpted what it is in our minds as what the modern-day spy should be. Suave, debonair, the man who always gets the woman, and the classy, if you will, individual who just has every tool under his belt. This actually gave us a physical
and
image.
Sometimes the belt is a cool tool too.
It's true. No, it's
thank
very
you,
true.
Q.
Ah, yes, Q. But
who makes cool gadgety things? In case you actually have never seen a James Bond film,
that's right.
Q is the inventor.
He's the inventor of the of the
MI6.
MI6. But so this is kind of what we've come to a point in terms of cinema where this character set the tone, if you will, for what was to be expected for every spy character, every spy film. Ultimately, it set the tone for what every spy character wanted to be like. I mean, most films that came after the fact were either replicas or duplicates of a James Bond-esque type character, or they were a parody of it, trying to pretend to get to that place, like trying to be suave, trying to be classy, trying to be that type of womanizing individual, and it just... Yeah.
Well, and I think it's interesting. I mean, I always, when we're doing big surveys like this, I like to try to mentally put things in context. And when James Bond in the popular culture was really taking off, that's the height of the Cold War. So
that's true.
I mean, the Cold War was a global war without, well, mostly without all the tanks and bombs and grenades and infantry soldiers and whatever. It was spy versus spy. It was spycraft, it was espionage, recon, you know, spy planes up in the air, launching satellites and starting to do things that way, infiltrations and
the space
counterintelligences and all these things. And so obviously you have James Bond on the silver screen, but then on the silver screen, mm-hmm. but on television you also have your Mission Impossible, your Get Smart, your Man from U.N.C.L.E. I mean, spies were in vogue because that was the way the battle was being fought. And of course, you've got like the way that spies fight. Obviously, I have no experience in espionage. But the way we're given to understand the way that spies fight is not with, you know, guns and knives and billy clubs and bombs and tanks and things all that often. It's actually with ideas, machinations, and, you know, kind of the chess game, you know, that is played on an international scale. And so, you know, move something over here and it, in like a row of dominoes, other things fall into place.
Yeah.
And it's all almost like a sense of wizardry. That's not very interesting to watch all that often on screen. And it certainly didn't match the style of storytelling that was very popular in, you know, the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And so you've got these caricature-type figures in the spy stories that they are spies, but they don't behave the way that actual espionage intelligence agents of that day behaved, because their point was not so much to reflect reality, but to draw you out of reality,
yeah,
while still addressing your concerns about, yeah, you know, the fighting between nations.
Yeah, kind of creating a sense of fantasy to the real life workings of what, you know, certain people are actually doing overseas at the time. So as we said, around this time, once James Bond was created and established as an icon, several things came out after the fact, you know, either shows or movies came out after the fact that almost mimicked the type of atmosphere that James Bond and the films that they made had. And, you know, that kind of gets us more into like the latter half of the century and even up to the current day, because then that's when you got things like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. It was a 1970s TV show that was surrounded by these two individuals, two agents of two different nations working together to create harmony and whatnot and work for an agency called U.N.C.L.E. But they were two suave, classy individuals who went on adventures, and this was a TV show. We actually got a chance to review the movie not too long ago. That was, what, was that this year? Or was that...
I think we did that last year. I could be wrong about that, but the reboot, essentially. The guy, not Guy Pearce.
Henry Cavill?
No, the director.
Oh, Guy Ritchie.
Guy Ritchie, thank you. Sorry. Like, these names. Pearce. I mean, we would both make terrible spies because we can't actually remember anything today, it's even though true. We both really enjoy the topic.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, obviously. I would say before we hop all the way into the modern,
yeah,
present day, there was this really cool moment, and this is, you know, the millennial in me and you undoubtedly, because I'm sure there were some spy movies in the late 70s, early 80s. I mean, obviously there were some James Bond movies because that kind of never really fully stopped. But I can distinctively remember 1995, they essentially relaunched the James Bond franchise with GoldenEye. And then in 1996, they introduced a modernized version of Mission Impossible, also, you know, based on a TV series from the 60s, like The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which you were talking about, with Tom Cruise. And they were really good. Both of them were really good. And, you know, you've got your distinctive, recognizable theme music, right, from each of them. And yet you have, I guess I always viewed it as an upgraded, modernized version of the characters. You didn't have your caricatures anymore. You actually had spy characters that were existing in the gritty, dirty, underhanded underbelly of the actual world. You know, fighting a battle that no one else ever saw.
True.
With, you know, with gadgets and gizmos and things, you know, things that had become part of the genre by that point. You really don't have a James Bond movie without a car that does something amazing, or I don't like a pen or even a gun, you know, something that does something out of the ordinary. Similar with Mission Impossible. I mean, the gum, red light, green light, mash them together, kaboom. But, and that was phenomenal. That's obviously I was born in the 80s, and so in the 90s that's where most of my memories start. I have a horrible memory when it comes to my earliest years, but more into that older childhood and puberty, I guess, all through that, like I can remember a lot of the things that I loved at that time. And GoldenEye I was really impressed with, and Mission Impossible I was really impressed with and would watch repeatedly.
The films?
Now, the films, yeah. Now, the James Bond franchise took a quick nosedive after GoldenEye because they went back into unnecessarily campy land. The Mission Impossible films, in some ways, in my opinion, took themselves a little too seriously for a while after the first one and before we cut Tom Cruise's hair again and got serious again. But
Just a little bit. I have a beef with the second Mission Impossible film,
so do I.
It's a horrible film, and no offense to John Woo, who was the director of that film, but yeah, don't touch the franchise again. Just really
yeah, it just really didn't work. It really didn't work. But they recovered. I would say their more recent stuff, and we have another one coming out next year.
That's true.
Their more recent stuff has been really good. The franchise, the Mission Impossible franchise. It's one of the only things that I still enjoy when I see Tom Cruise in a movie.
It's very true.
In my opinion, that's just me talking, not a blanket statement. But
no, that's my feeling as well.
And James Bond had to be rebooted essentially and remodernized in an extra gritty way with Casino Royale with Daniel Craig. And that has run for several films, and they have continued to embrace the dark, gritty textures, in addition to having the gadgets and the explosions and the women and all that kind of stuff that you expect from James Bond. Thankfully, they have not diverted into too much campiness.
Yeah.
Spectre obviously had a little bit of a campy kind of feel with the villain that wasn't, I don't think, necessary, but it's the way they decided to do it. And they've got another one of those coming. I believe it's filming in 2018 or late 2017, and then it'll be in theaters in 2019, but possibly the last outing after the previously said to be last outing of Daniel Craig as James Bond.
True. And likewise, as you had several types of adaptations, not even adaptations, but like we said, similar shows and films that came after the James Bond franchise, you also had some comedic takes, if you will, some shows that kind of delved more on the aspect of adding humor where seriousness usually was more at the forefront of. Like, sure. Not that to say that the James Bond films were serious. No, they had their comedic parts of their campiness, but this lent more of itself on the comedic aspect rather than...
like a full-on parody kind of thing.
Exactly. And that's films or shows such as, like we said, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which was a comedic series. It had its comedic parts. Get Smart. We were talking about that one, the original Get mm-hmm. Smart. I was mentioning, I remembered I Spy, which actually featured Bill Cosby. Uniquely enough, all these shows have been revamped into modern day films. I Spy was a film that was redone with Owen Wilson and Eddie Murphy. Get Smart with Steve Carell
and Anne Hathaway.
And then we were saying The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Obviously, we talked about the name we couldn't remember, Armie Hammer, and Henry Cavill.
Know that before, Eddie. We remembered it in time.
I barely remembered it. So
Alicia Vikander.
Alicia Vikander. Yeah. But having that transition over into understanding that not every spy film has to have a seriousness to it. It doesn't have to be always focused on, you know, death and destruction. And, you know, if it's not serious and it's, you know, campy, and if it's not campy, it's serious. Having the mindset of, hey, let's just do a spy film that has, you know, a comedic background to it. It's funny. That kind of broke the mold a little bit and kind of lent more of the leniency, if you will, in the spy genre. It was no longer about, you know, war and the death of individuals and people who were going to go do stuff and they may not come home. And it transitioned to a little bit more of a lax genre. And take that as you will. I
think the properties themselves, so much depends upon tone, really. I mean, the tone, because now that I'm sitting here actually thinking about it, at the same time that you have... you know, I was mentioning, for me, because of my age, GoldenEye really sticks in my mind. But before GoldenEye, you had Jack Ryan. You had The Hunt for Red October. You had Clear and Present Danger, Patriot Games.
The Sum of All Fears.
That came after GoldenEye. But, always been a serious character. And there's absolutely a spy component to a lot of what happens in those films. Certainly the action thriller angle is there. But... So it's not to say that the seriousness wasn't there until GoldenEye and the newer, you know, version of Mission Impossible. But you're right, there was a campiness. And I think that and the parody aspect, that angle was, especially in the mid to late 70s and early 80s, that was kind of the vibe that was very popular. You either had like street racing movie or some kind of a commentary that usually was poking a lot of fun at, I guess you could say, the way that we've been doing things recently. Yeah. So like, as the Cold War was starting to fall out of favor, I guess, in popular consciousness, then you had openings to be funny with the whole spy dynamic. And honestly, the whole time through the television programs, that's the way you sustained the spy story, was by not being overly serious and giving people the anxiety in their escapism that they had in the real world the whole rest of the day. I mean, it was a way of releasing some of that tension while talking about the same topics that they were always talking about around the water cooler or in school or wherever, you know, whatever, wherever they were. But, but then by the time you get into the late 70s, early 80s, yes, the Cold War is still going on. Yes, tension is still high. But by then, you've also got a lot of just disgruntledness with the way that these major world powers and governments are handling the entire situation of essentially talking with each other around a table or in secret or whatever. And so you've got a lot of dissent. You've got distrust, suspicion, and rather than lean heavily into like almost a noir kind of really dark palette and dark storytelling, some of the creators decided to go funny.
And that's true. Like if you look at towards the latter half of the 80s, early 90s, that's when films such as Spy Hard, starring Leslie Nielsen, came about, which was...
Who was like the king of parody.
Oh, of course. Between Airplane... you had Naked Gun, all the Naked Gun movies, and then Spy Hard. The man just loved to make fun of stuff. But this was one of those films that filled that niche in terms of parody around this time, because then we started getting, as the 90s began to roll around, there wasn't much of a other than the seriousness of the spy films at the time, like you were saying, Clear and Present Danger, Patriot Games, and so forth. There wasn't really another parody until Mike Myers came into the fray and brought about, I believe it was in like 1998 or 99, he brought in Austin Powers.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a response to the popularity of GoldenEye and Mission Impossible.
Oh, it was directly pointing the finger at those movies saying, well, you know what, we're going to have fun. Forget you guys. We're just going to...
And it was brilliant.
It was.
I mean, it was goofy, but it was brilliant. It was the perfect moment to do something like that.
Trying to remember. I'm stuck on dates. I have to find
That's out. Okay. It was after those two movies and before some of the others, like what I'm really excited to talk about next, Jason Bourne. So, because the entire popular concept of what constitutes a spy, like what is a spy, right? So you've got the whole intrigue and trying to solve mysteries and all that kind of stuff. But then in reality, you also have people who are arranging assassinations and people who are trying to topple governments and others who are trying to stop them from toppling governments and all of that. And I think as the understanding of what the espionage world actually had become involved in over the years, during and in the waning years of the Cold War, like how that extended into all kinds of dark places, yeah, and really poor decisions on a large scale, and a lot of irresponsibility on behalf of entire world governments, including our own. And so you get all of that into the hopper, and suddenly your spies are literally weapons. They are assassins on assignment, not necessarily always thinking for themselves. And that's where you've got, the Bourne identity fits straight into that groove, where he's adrift in the ocean, has lost his memory, and is trying to piece things together, but he knows how to fight, he knows how to kill, he knows how to get out of tough situations, and governments know who he is. Like, that's, in a way, that's absolutely the definition of a spy. Now, was he a James Bond type of spy? No. But he was very much like what probably some spies in the modern day are responsible for.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know that we've created them with the Treadstone Project or anything like that, but they're people being on assignment to do the things that other people would never be able to stomach.
Yeah.
That whole angle really took off, you know, with the Bourne Identity, the Bourne Supremacy, the Bourne Ultimatum. We'll forget about the Bourne Legacy. And again, they're talking about doing another one with Matt Damon, bringing Jason Bourne back into the Bourne franchise.
Yeah. And uniquely enough, I would have to say that it was with the Bourne franchise that sort of brought back in the mindset of what the early films of the spy genre were about. Yes, the Jack Ryan films by Tom Clancy, they touched on it, but it was more of a political aspect rather than the spy aspect.
Well, and he was Secret Service, right?
He was Secret Service, and so, but everything was all within the realm of political decisions. The president was making underhanded decisions. There was other drug lords from Colombia that were doing this and that. It was all, or the IRA. Is it the IRA? The Irish? Yeah. Okay. The IRA had a beef with whatever, whatnot. It seemed to be a lot more based in politics than it was in actual espionage. The Bourne franchise kind of brought everything back around full circle to kind of say, hey, this right here is what the root of a spy film is about. And I think it touches on it really well in terms of the reality based in it. it wasn't so much as, oh, he knows Kung Fu, he does this. It's a lot of the scenes were really unique in terms of the fighting style, the fighting sequences.
Oh, the fight choreography and the Bourne Identity.
Yeah.
Made you want to go see it again in the theater.
Oh, yeah.
Just to see how they pulled off that kind of fighting. It was very fresh.
Oh, yeah.
And very brutal. Like, it felt like they were actually, you know, stabbing pencils through each other and all that jazz.
Oh, yeah. And I think that kind of woke a sense of understanding within directors at that time. It brought about a new, shall we say, like a resurrection of the root of the spy genre, because then shortly after, wasn't The Recruit a film that came out soon after that? And that was a film with Colin Farrell, Al Pacino.
It had a lot to do with the training of spy type people and how to detect liars, and I mean, it was all the mind games, and I mean, it was, I love that movie. That was a fantastic movie. I mean, it's interesting because as the genre has evolved into, you know, now, even when you do touch upon previously existing properties, when you do make another Mission Impossible film, when you do make another James Bond film, when you do, you know, try to give The Man from U.N.C.L.E. a renaissance, that, darn it, the film deserved, and people just didn't go see it. It definitely needs, you know, a sequel. But then, aside from all those, you've also got some sort of off the beaten path gems, like we were talking before the show, Colombiana, with Zoe Saldana, that is extremely rooted, like very gritty, very street level, hard grittiness, and rooted in actual activities of actual governments in third world countries.
Oh, yeah.
Like first world governments acting in third world governments and cause it, like, again, tipping over those dominoes and causing a cascade, and the effect that it has on the life of, you know, this young woman and how she grows up and becomes ruthless assassin bent on vengeance, even though that's not what she wants to be.
Yeah.
It's what she's been made into because of all these uncontrollable circumstances around her.
And ironically, that itself is, if you will, the heart of what the Bourne franchise is about. Somebody who is, he's aware of it, but it's instinctive what's been ingrained in him. It's almost like this is, even at a point in his life where he may not even want to be this anymore, it's instinctive. It's ingrained. This is who they are made to be at this point in time in the film. I was thinking, and we didn't write it in here, and I'll have to make the notes of it later, but another one that I was thinking of that is kind of a good, it's actually a good spy film in terms of internally, The Departed.
It has its
aspects, but, you know, I was just thinking in terms of, you know, having to turn face and be a counter operative or counter agent or counter spy for this group while you're also working with these groups and whatnot. But that mindset is the direction of where most people or most directors ended up taking some of the films in terms of spy films, because then you get into the movies like the Fast and the Furious films, where the idea of espionage,
no, you're right,
becomes more of a whirlwind of CGI and Vin Diesel in the latter half. But in the first half of the films, obviously there's a bit more of a root in street racing, but the idea is that you have a cop who's infiltrating a world that is unknown to him for the sake of trying to find the true criminals that are kind of the puppet masters behind everything else going on. I hate to say this, but I actually enjoyed the first half of the Fast and the Furious franchise just for that reason, because it's a great idea. It was such a unique take in the more modern age, but unfortunately, like we've said time and time again, the latter half of the series just kind of went the way of the dodo, and they were like, hey.
Well, similarly to what you saw with Pierce Brosnan's version of James Bond, it becomes this campy, overly, you know, CGI mess that really isn't all that interesting. And obviously it still gets butts in the seats. Like it, they still sell tickets, and that's why we keep having more of them. But, you know, it doesn't have the same feel as the earlier films. Mm-hmm. You know, speaking specifically of, you know, the Fate of the Furious, you know, something like that just doesn't have the same feel as the Fast and the Furious, the original one. And, you know, and that's because they've had to change the basic dynamics of the story, and not just because one of their primary performers is not available, is not around anymore to do the part, but because it has become a different story. They are now essentially contractors for the government to do things with cars, with fast cars and planes and helicopters and submarines and all kinds of weird things. But it is still trying in some ways to be a spy movie, and to do that whole, you know, the whole family-based mentality of Dom Toretto and the other people in his crew, you know, we're family and we're
friends,
gonna,
family.
Yeah, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it definitely, it's that, what you were talking about earlier in the show about the patriotism angle, that like, you know, that core, that it's the motivation is right, but then everything around you is wrong, and the way the story is being told. But
so much is wrong with those,
you know,
movies.
But definitely, I would agree with you. The Fast and the Furious group of films has a huge spy component in it. I mean, that's the way that Paul Walker's character is. That's what he is in the beginning. He's a spy.
Yeah.
Just not internationally. I mean, at first, obviously they do go international.
Yeah, and
quickly.
There's so much I would love to argue about with this film, because it's just, it gets on my last nerve. But we're not going to, you know.
Also, I do have to correct something.
Hi.
I am personally ashamed and embarrassed in myself.
Uh-oh.
Because I completely neglected Jason Bourne.
The recent one.
The movie Jason Bourne.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was off my rocker. No, I said something along the lines of, and they're talking about doing another one. Yeah, no, they totally already did another one, and we saw it and enjoyed it and reviewed it on the podcast.
It's true.
And it, you know what it is? It's because I don't have it in my DVD collection yet. That's my problem. Anyway, so side note. So I'm covering
he's covering
my bases,
his butt there.
Covering my butt. We did actually see it. We enjoyed it. It was a good return to form. Moving on.
But that's here's the unique thing. I love the fact that the film actually, the spy genre, if you will. Sorry, I was kind of gathering myself. The spy genre is actually coming back, and like I said, with films like the Bourne franchise and The Recruit and other films, there's been a renaissance, like you said, a great word to use, a renaissance of the spy genre itself back into media, in terms of television shows, in terms of newer movies. We were talking about earlier the film The Constant Gardener,
yeah,
which is a great film Rachel Weisz.
Anything John le Carré,
exactly, and that was
who's the book writer, yes. The writer of the books that the movies are based on.
The film's directed by Fernando Mieres. That's his name. But but having
he might contend with you on that, but I'll take it. I'll accept it.
When he calls in to you know, quarrel with that, I will gladly.
We'll fangirl to death, yeah.
Exactly. But, I mean,
a real Hollywood director wants to talk to us. I don't care that it's just to correct the pronunciation of his last name.
That doesn't want to talk about a Jew-centric idea. But even
that was stepping over the bounds.
Even shows like one of your favorite shows, Alias.
Oh yeah, love that. Well, I love the first couple of seasons of that show, especially season two. That was really enjoyable for me with Irina Derevko. Sydney Bristow, Jennifer Garner. Come on,
it's true.
That show was so good.
Yeah,
thank you, J.J. Abrams. I mean, eventually, no more thanking you, J.J. Abrams, because it didn't stay good, but it was good at first. It was very enjoyable.
But like we said, a lot of those films that are those shows and films that are coming out, like we said, there's been a lot more Bourne films coming out. There's a new Mission Impossible.
Almost done film. They're actually doing pickup shots, I think, now. I think primary production is ending. I think they're in reshoots. Anyway, comes out next year, 2018.
So, all in all, to say, you know what? The spy genre is kind of on an uphill, if you will, kind of going back into the forefront of cinema. You know, the Jack Ryan film was only a couple of years ago. The new one, Shadow
Chris
Recruit,
Pine.
With Chris Pine. So they're coming full circle, and it's coming back to the heart of what spy films are. And let's hope that with this new film, obviously we didn't get a chance to mention it, but the film that we're going to be seeing next week, the whole reason why we're prepping you guys, the listeners, for is because we're planning to see the sequel for the Kingsman movie, which is a spy-esque film.
Fits in the genre, for
sure.
Fits
in the genre. So,
Her Majesty's Secret Service, right?
Exactly. So we're kind of excited to see where the genre is heading because of the fact that it was once in a place where parody and seriousness were just left and right, constant happening. But let's hope that as they continue these franchises and as they continue, you know, bringing in more and more of these types of films. I mean, that wasn't a spy film. I was thinking that was, I was going to say Murder on the Orient Express.
No, it's a murder mystery.
It's a mystery, mystery.
But I think there is a spy on the train, though. Anyway, the other thing that I do want to say to piggyback off of what you're saying, and I know we're getting close to wrapping the show, but the success of shows like The Americans and Homeland, which are very serious and very rooted in...
True that.
I guess the unredacted elements that people do feel like they know about how spies operate when they're, you know, embedded in another culture or trying to influence a foreign culture or whatever. I mean, those shows have been incredibly successful, shown a lot of underhanded stuff, really rough stuff and rough personalities. And yet I think that the quality of the storytelling has been so high and so well respected. I think that that type of programming we're going to start seeing in film as well. Not that we've always never seen it, but I think that that kind of angle is definitely of interest to certain streams of the mainstream audience.
Yeah.
Certain threads of the mainstream audience.
So let us know what you think. How do you feel about spy films? Do you have a favorite? Are there any films that we didn't mention that they're, you know, you just can't do without? Let us know on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or on our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. And we'd love to hear your thoughts. Like we said, this is all for preparation for next week. So I hope you're ready to hear about a little bit of
Eggsy
and the Kingsman Secret Service, because we're going to dive right into that film. Before we go, let you know a little bit of movie news. Patty Jenkins is confirmed. She will be the next director for Wonder Woman, the new sequel.
Yeah, it's about dang time. I mean, they took their sweet time.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Deciding to pay her an amount of money that she quite frankly deserves even more, I think. Hopefully there's an option in her contract for revenue.
Oh, most definitely.
Getting a revenue share.
Well, with all the negotiations going on, I hope that was like at the forefront. It's like, oh, by the way, with as successful as this last one is, yeah, I want a piece of that. It is now recorded that with this new deal, she is now the highest paid female director in cinema right now. So kudos to Patty Jenkins. And you know what? I'm excited to see what's in store for Wonder Woman in the next film.
Likewise.
Just a little bit of upcoming weekend releases. We only have one, which is Darren Aronofsky's Mother, which debuts this Friday, which looks like a really weird movie, and I have no idea what it's about, so I couldn't tell you.
It's getting rave reviews.
Oh, well, they can have it, because I saw Black Swan. I'm okay. but that about wraps up another awesome episode of the Film Philosophers. Again, like I said, if you have any thoughts on the show, drop us a line on our Facebook page or our Twitter page, and we'd love to hear from you. So, but yeah, I think this was a good conversation.
We always think that.
I think so.
I agree with you. It was a good conversation. Now we're going to go into hiding.
That we are, because
we've said too much.
There are countries who know of us now. So, from all of us here at the Film Philosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Enrique.
Okay. Class dismissed.